Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of December. Wendell Potter is our guest this hour. His book is Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Wendell has been with us before, but it was before healthcare reform was passed in this country, so we'll get his take on what he thinks of the bill. He is now the senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He left his job, an executive position at Cigna, a top health insurance company, in May of 2008. He had a 23-year career in public relations and a 15-year career at two health insurance giants, Cigna and also Humana. And the book looks at all kinds of issues. It looks at America's healthcare system and how it got fashioned and why it is fashioned the way it is. The really gripping parts of the book deal with how the insurance companies denied claims, how they responded, which is a fascinating chapter, to Michael Moore's film Sicko, and how they had everything in place to counteract what was in that film. And it looks at how Wendell made a personal transformation, being a top executive, PR executive of one of the major health insurance companies, and what he saw that made him decide that he just couldn't do this anymore. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him, as we always do, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you are welcome to do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Wendell Potter, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for that wonderful introduction and for this opportunity. Good to be on the program.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I'm so glad you put all of this together in a nice book form now, because it's filled with so much information. It's quite valuable.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Why don't we start? I mean, there's so much to talk about, but let's start, because I didn't know the details of this, of the campaign against the movie Sicko. People in the health insurance business were very worried about what Michael Moore was going to put in the film, and nobody knew exactly what he was going to put in the film, but you were prepared for it.
Yes, absolutely. It was important for us to be prepared for it. There were two things that were going on. One was obviously the fact that Michael Moore was doing a movie on the health insurance industry, and he was playing things close to the vest. We didn't know very much about really what angle he'd be taking or what point of view he would have in the movie. We suspected that the insurers wouldn't fare all that well in the movie, but we were kind of hopeful that he might be going after pharmaceutical companies more than insurers. The other thing that was going on was that the industry's polling people, the pollsters, were saying that Americans were getting really fed up with the American healthcare system, and in particular the American insurance system, and that for the first time since our pollsters had been doing surveys and polling for the industry, more than half of Americans were saying that the government should take a much more active role in the healthcare system. And this alarmed insurance company executives, because there was great concern that there would be a tipping point at which people would say, you know, let's get rid of these for-profit insurance companies and try something else that might be more fair and more equitable to Americans. So with that as kind of a backdrop, we were very worried that Michael Moore's movie might be something that would cause that tipping point to happen. And so it was very important to mount a campaign to discredit Michael Moore as a filmmaker and the movie itself, which, of course, we found out by sending a spy to the premiere of the movie at the Cannes Film Festival. We knew that it was going to be taken out after the health insurance system, and how even people who have insurance find themselves often without the coverage that they thought that would be there for them.
I just had this picture in my mind. You've got this spy who's taking notes immediately before the applause really starts at the end of the film, gets on the phone to many of you who were gathered in a conference call because you were all eagerly awaiting, oh, did he get us? Did he get Cigna? Who did he get? What are we going to do? We better distribute a memo so that we won't have any deer caught in the headlights.
Oh, absolutely! It was a much anticipated phone call from France, And of course, it was late in the evening because of the time difference, and we were, I don't even recall now how many, if I even knew how many total people were on the call, but representatives from, I'm sure, every major insurance company in the country was on the call. It was orchestrated by the trade group America's Health Insurance Plans. In fact, it was an employee of that trade group that went to the south of France to be there for the premiere and who took notes in the back of the dark theater and called us with his report on the movie as soon as it was over. It was something that we were all anticipating and dreading to a certain extent because we were fearful that it would be quite a slam at the insurance industry as it was, and we were obviously all interested in knowing how our own individual companies fared in the movie.
And when you saw the movie, Wendell, it almost brought you to tears.
Oh, it did, because there were real stories in this movie. If anyone has not seen it, I really encourage you to see it, because Michael Moore is a, at least with this film, I know from personal experience, knowing the industry as I do, he was very careful to make sure his facts were correct about both this healthcare system in this country, the individuals he portrayed in the movie, and the healthcare systems abroad that have done a better job of making sure that their citizens have access to good health care. It was done, I think, extremely well to make the point that in the richest country on the planet, we allow things to happen to our citizens who think they've got adequate insurance, but find out when it's really too late in many cases that they don't, that their claims are being denied, or that they're being denied coverage for a life-saving treatment. And what I had in my career been able to do until 2007, there were some other things that happened that year, but I was always able to think of the problems in our healthcare systems in terms of numbers. Like, I knew that 45 million people at that time didn't have health insurance, but when you think of it as just a number, you can go on to the next thought you have and not worry too much about it. But when you are confronted with the flesh and blood representation of those figures, it's an entirely different matter, and that's why I think the movie was so effective. He told the story through the eyes and voices of real people, and some of those people were people who supposedly had good coverage with Cigna and found out that they were not getting the coverage that the doctor said they needed.
And another of those flesh and blood experiences came when you visited this healthcare fair in Southern Appalachia, in an area close to where you had grown up, and there were 300,000 people who were being treated. Two-thirds of the people, you write, had jobs but no health insurance.
Well, that number is a total of the number of people that this organization, Remote Area Medical, has served over the past few years. There were thousands who were there that day, and it was just stunning to see what I saw when I walked through the gates of this county fairgrounds in Wise County, Virginia, which is in the southwestern part of the state in the Southern Appalachians. And people were lined up in lines that stretched out of view, and it was raining, so these folks were just soaking wet. And the care that was being provided to them in many cases, these people were lined up to get care in animal stalls and barns. And others, I could see, were being treated in or under open-sided tents. You could walk around, and I had my camera with me. I just snapped some photographs of people being cared for. There was no privacy. There was no dignity. And it was just incredible to see this. It was almost like it was dreamlike or nightmarish. It was hard to imagine that I was still in the U.S. It was like stepping onto a movie set or something that you just completely could not associate with reality, that these people were U.S. citizens. And it became clear to me right off the bat that these were people that I could have grown up with. And chances are there were some relatives of mine in that crowd. And there was no way after that I could possibly think of Americans who were in such straits as just just a statistic. It just wasn't possible from that point on.
And then you're also struck because you developed a conscience about all of this. We spent some of last hour talking about this business of equity and how Americans just don't seem to be very concerned about it. But it's hard not to be when you couple with what you saw there with the retired Cigna executive, the former chair and CEO, Wilson Taylor, whose salary in 2000, I believe it was, you write, his last year with the company was $24 million, which didn't include additional millions that he reaped from stock options and deferred compensation. So that the people who were part of paying for their health insurance premiums were paying for this guy's house that, well, you may want to describe it.
Well, yeah, it was that year is in November. The Architectural Digest had a big spread on a remarkable house outside of Philadelphia, it was, I think the headline for the story was Romancing the Stone, and that was because it was a stone house, many of the artifacts, the furnishings came from France and from other places in Europe where the architect and designer had traveled to get the finest and most architecturally appealing details for this massive house that had a children's cottage or grandchildren's cottage, among other things. And it just struck me as I was reading this outrageous story and the photographs of this unbelievable mansion that that people who were enrolled in Cigna's health benefit plans helped to pay for that, helped to make sure that he walked out the door with $24 million and built that house for him that almost none of us will ever see, of course. It was such a contrast. And I knew also that people were having to stand in line to get care in animal stalls so that he could live that way.
And a lot of those people could have been given insurance with the amount of money that it took to build that house.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Yeah. Well, let's jump ahead because all our phone lines are going with people to talk with you. But let's talk about what happened in terms of health care reform in this country. Are you happy with what we have now?
No, I don't think many people would say that they're happy or completely satisfied with what we have now, what the president signed. I did say at the time that Congress passed the bill that it was a good thing that it did pass. I was hopeful that something would pass that would be a start. What I think of this legislation is the kind of the end of the beginning. We have a long way to go before our healthcare system will be equitable and fair and efficient and affordable. But this is a start. And as you noted in the introduction, in one chapter of the book, I provide a look at the history of our healthcare system and the history of efforts to reform it. And every time there's been an attempt to reform it, the special interests have been more and more powerful. So the fact that we got anything passed at all was unusual when you look at this historically. When you consider the millions and millions of dollars that were thrown at the effort to defeat meaningful reform, people need to understand this in that context, that what we got was far from perfect, but we got a start. And hopefully over time, that legislation can be improved. It is being implemented, and some things will take effect in just a few days after we turn over to January the 1st, 2011, that are worthwhile, and some things already have been implemented that really are beneficial to a lot of people. So yes, there's a lot that can be said favorably about this legislation, but it falls short in other ways, and there's still a lot to do.
Wendell, did people in the health insurance industry actually write a good chunk of this bill?
That's what happens in Washington. There are so many lobbyists in Washington, and a lot of people who are lobbyists or former members of Congress or former staff members or former lawyers who've worked on Capitol Hill and have written legislation in the past. So, yes, it's not at all unusual. In fact, it's common for lobbyists to suggest legislative language for bills of this nature. So there's no doubt at all that some of the provisions were written by industry or at least inspired by industry.
And we have heard, as you well know, from a lot of people in the midterm elections that they want to repeal health care reform. You wrote an interesting piece in Newsweek recently saying they may make this a battle cry, but once the health insurance lobbyists arrive January 3rd, forget it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I thought, and there may yet be a vote that's taken to repeal it in the House because they know that it won't be it won't make it through Congress because the Democrats still control the Senate, and even if it did, the president would veto any kind of repeal legislation. So there may be a big show on the House side with all these newly elected members feeling an obligation to vote on repealing it because they've persuaded so many of their constituents that it's bad legislation, that they feel that they need to do that. But it'll just be for show. And the reality is what is of most concern to me, and I think most of your listeners should be and most Americans should be, is the effort by the insurance industry and other special interests to change it, to strip out some of the most important consumer protections and some of the most important new regulations on the insurance industry that they don't like. That's what really will be going on, and they'll be using so many euphemisms and clever campaigns, PR strategies to try to make us think that the things that the industry wants are things that we should want. I can assure you they're not.
What don't they like?
They don't like the fact that they'll have to spend 80% of what they take in premiums on medical care. That's one of the things that will take effect on January the 1st. It's a requirement that they spend at least 80%, and if it's a large group insurance account, 85% of what they take in on premiums on medical care. It pertains to something called a medical loss ratio. Insurers consider that what they spend on medical care to be a loss, and it certainly is from Wall Street's perspective. They hate to see that medical loss ratio go up, and this legislation provides a floor. They have to spend at least 80%, insurers do, on medical care, or they have to issue a rebate to the people who are enrolled in their medical plan. So they don't like that. They don't like the fact that the government can tell them to spend a certain amount. And Wall Street especially hates it because they are constantly pressuring these insurers to spend less and less and less on medical care, and they've been getting away with it for years. In 1993, for example, 95% of everything that we spent in premiums was paid out by our insurance companies on medical care. Now it's down to 80% on average, and often below that. So, and that's a consequence of the conversion of a lot of our insurance companies to for-profit status, mm-hmm. and the consolidation in the industry, and this relentless pressure from Wall Street.
So they were preferring stone mansions with French kitchens?
Oh, that's exactly right. That
really?
that really does. It makes it possible for these executives to be able to afford these stone mansions with French kitchens outside of Philadelphia and other major cities. And another thing they don't like is restrictions on their ability to shift more and more of the cost of health care from them to us. They've been shifting more and more of us into high-deductible plans, and this legislation will at least cap the amount of money that we'll be forced to spend out of our own pockets before we get insurance. And, of course, the insurance companies don't like that. They want to be able to shift as much of the cost of care to us as possible, which is why well over 25 million of us are underinsured. There are 50 million of us who don't have insurance of any kind, and another 25 million, and probably much more than that now, that's a two-year-old figure, who are underinsured. These people are in plans that require them to spend so much money out of their own pockets that they can't afford to go to the doctor. They can't afford to pick up their medications. And in some of these cases, the benefits are so limited that they're often worthless. And the insurance industry doesn't like those kinds of constraints. And they will argue... and here's some buzz terms to watch out for. You'll be hearing them, and they'll be said to try to make us think that what they're proposing is reasonable and in our own best interest. They will say that what we need is a common-sense, market-based approach to health care.
Mm.
That sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And they will say that they need to have benefit design flexibility so that they can give Americans more choice. Now, that sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are buzz terms to hide what is really going on. They want to be able to have the flexibility to design more and more junk products and more products that allow them to shift more and more cost to us and that allow them to segment the population so that people who are older and sicker pay far, far more than younger people. And just continue along their ways to wrecking our healthcare system.
Did you write some of those buzz terms, Wendell?
Oh, absolutely. That's part of what you do as you're, if you're a PR executive in the industry. You pay a lot of attention to language. And that's one of the things that struck me when I switched sides is that the lack of attention that advocates of reform have paid to language. What it seemed to me was that the advocates of reform and the Democrats in Congress and the White House were not up to the task to counter some of the spin, some of these buzz terms, and that worked so effectively not only during the debate, but also during the midterm campaigns. We heard, I'm sure everyone in your listening audience heard that this legislation represented a government takeover.
Over and over again. Uh-huh.
Well, that's by design, and that term came straight out of the insurance industry, released its consultants and language experts. Much time was devoted and many resources to finding just the right words to scare people away from reform, and that was one of the favorites. It was at the core of the industry's fear-mongering campaign that was conducted behind the scenes. When I say behind the scenes, it was the industry didn't want its fingerprints to be on the campaign. So it gave those talking points to Republican candidates largely and to organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other allies of the industry so that they could disseminate these lies and misinformation.
Wendell Potter is our guest. His book is Deadly Spin, An Insurance Company Insider Speaks Out on How Corporate PR is Killing Healthcare and Deceiving Americans. Wendell is now the Senior Fellow on Healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. Our phone number, keep it in mind, our lines are all busy, but here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Wendell Potter and start our calls with Brad. Hi, where are you, Brad? There you go. Hi, Brad.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Brad.
Oh, hi there. Wendell, unfortunately, Medicare isn't actually single payer. You have to purchase a separate Part D drug plan and Medigap plan. And a friend of mine has issues with getting appeals approved for things like compounded prescriptions at out-of-network pharmacies with this Part D plan. Can you recommend any reputable companies that sell Part D and Medigaps that are better at approving appeals and providing halfway decent customer service?
Brett, I would be reluctant to offer advice on that, and you're right. It's not, you can't call it single payer when there are multiple companies competing for your business and private companies, and that was, as you well know, designed during the Bush administration, and that certainly was a program that was designed largely by the insurance and pharmaceutical industry. I would direct you to organizations like Consumers Union, which publishes consumer reports, and some organizations like that you trust have done some analysis of this, and I would be hesitant to suggest one right now. The plans change year to year, and some drugs are on the list of drugs that are approved at certain coverages 1 year, and they change the next. So I would be reluctant. AARP offers products. It's a big source of income for AARP is selling insurance, both supplemental insurance and Medicare HMO products. And they have a big following, but I would prefer if I were to be making a choice to look at an organization that doesn't sell a product, but does try to evaluate them. But you will also need to just take into consideration, if you're considering a plan for yourself or for someone you know or a loved one, what medications a person is taking and what level of coverage you get for the specific medication if you're on maintenance medication. And frankly, though, there is not a lot of information that I'm aware of in terms of how successful people are in winning appeals against companies. These products are not regulated by state insurance commissioners, so there's not a lot of information out there, unfortunately.
Dana is next on the road. Hi, Dana.
Hi. A friend of mine is losing his employer-provided health care insurance for himself and his family at the end of January and decided he could pay for a policy just to cover his child, who's perfectly healthy. And in calling around to the various insurance companies, he discovered that after January 1, none of them anywhere will be offering standalone policies for child, sick or well. And this is because it was finally explained to us that it was the new Health Care Reform Act makes it illegal for an insurance company to turn down a child with pre-existing conditions. So in essentially in retaliation, they're not going to offer standalone policies for any children. And I'm just wondering, how can they spin this as anything except just plain evil and taking it out on the kids?
There's no way you can. I mean, their posture in something like this is that they have to stay in business, and if one company pulls out, then that means that the companies that remain will get an inordinate number of sick kids. So they offer it up in trying to explain it that way, but it is evil. And it's nothing more than just looking more at the bottom line than it is looking at the health and well-being of children. Some states are requiring insurers to get back in the insurance market for kids. California is one that I'm aware of, and I think other states have done this as well to force these companies that if these companies want to continue to write policies in the states, they have to issue child-only policies. I'm not sure what it is where your friend lives, but I would encourage them to call the insurance commissioner, find out if there are any companies left in the state that are offering them, and to get actively involved in trying to get the state to do the same thing that California and some other states have done to require these companies to do the right thing.
Are you familiar with the national trend here? Are there a lot of people who are losing their employer-based care right now?
Yes. It's been going on for some time. And the thing that most people don't realize is that insurance companies are driving people out of the market in their quest for profits. Angela Brawley, the CEO of WellPoint, the largest in terms of membership with more than 30 million Americans enrolled in their benefit plans, famously said on a call with analysts and financial analysts and investors that her company would not sacrifice profits for membership. In other words, they'll get rid of unprofitable members just so that they can meet Wall Street's profit expectations. And all the big for-profit companies have been doing this. They've been purposely shedding members that cost them money. And they do this through rescinding policies when people get sick. And that's one thing the new legislation will try to make illegal. They've been purging accounts of small businesses that are costing them more than they want to pay in medical claims, which is a reason why now far fewer than half, small businesses are now able to offer health care benefits to their employees. So more and more people are losing their coverage. It's not just because of the recession. More than 50 million Americans now do not have insurance, and a large number of those people are that way because they can't get their coverage. Their employers no longer offer it.
Well, how does the part of the bill that makes sure that almost everybody has coverage, that we all have to have coverage, when does that kick in, and how does that kick in, Wendell?
Well, it'll be 2014. It's a few years down the road, and there's a long lead time for a lot of this legislation to be implemented, and that, frankly, was giving the insurance companies more than ample time, in my view, to get ready for this change, but also to get Americans, I guess, accustomed to the idea of having to buy coverage. The reality is most of us do, so it shouldn't be a big deal. And those who don't have coverage would certainly like to be able to buy it at an affordable price. And the legislation, even though it requires us all to have insurance unless we're a conscientious objector of some nature or just simply can't afford it, and there's some ways that people can avoid buying coverage without paying a penalty. But it doesn't kick in until 2014. So until then, a lot of folks are just going to continue to have a problem finding coverage. The states will have to set up high-risk pools, and some already have them. A little bit more than half the states have high-risk pools for people who can't get coverage otherwise. But the premiums are expensive.
Right.
That's a problem.
Yeah. Dana, thanks for the call. Myrna from Middleton. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Myrna.
Yeah, I have so many comments. I'm trying to sort them through really quickly and certainly a bottom-line question. I'm a mental health professional, and I pay for my own premiums, which are not inexpensive. And the CEO of my local HMO, who I was privileged to speak with, tells me it's only going to get worse because people like me are going to have to pay for the people that are in the high-risk pool that the insurance companies and HMOs are having to pick up. So that's comment number one. Comment number two is the previous caller illustrated very well about the child why we need a portable plan, which my understanding of what's going on would be a public option. It's ridiculous to have an employer-based plan because, obviously, if you lose your job, you don't have health insurance, and that's why this issue has mushroomed. But my bottom-line question is I have a huge amount of frustration and anger about Congress's callousness. And I'm just wondering, sir, since you are now joining us on the other side, other than writing this book, is there anything that you can do? Is there anything that we can do to alleviate this situation? Because I don't see Congress budging on this issue in the current political climate.
No, I don't think Congress will. In fact, we've got to be watching, keeping an eye on what Congress does to make sure that they don't make things worse, and they very possibly can. We're just all going to have to be much more politically active than we've been accustomed to, and I know that a lot of people already have been, and to the point of almost becoming cynical because it seems like their efforts are just not worthwhile or making a big difference. But unless we do stay in there and keep working, we'll never be able to achieve the kind of healthcare system we need. But we're also going to have to ultimately look at changing how we finance campaigns, and we're going to have to look at lobbying reform once again. Corporations have the upper hand in this country. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. We've got to change that. The Supreme Court ruling from earlier this year that allows companies to be considered persons and so consequently can make direct contributions to campaigns really affected the outcome of the midterms in a very significant way. And there's millions, billions of money, dollars in soft money that influence the campaigns and finance these fear-mongering, lie-based campaigns that were successful and led to so many people being elected to Congress that were just demagoguing a lot of issues in healthcare in particular. So we probably can't expect that we're going to see the kinds of reform and the kind of healthcare system we really need until we can figure out how we can get people in Congress who are not beholden to the special interest of Wall Street in particular, the big for-profit insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, because you can get very cynical and disgusted with Congress. But what we saw happening in the midterm is a consequence of the power of the corporations. They were able to get rid of so many members of Congress who were willing to vote for comprehensive and meaningful reform that this always that threat to members that if you don't do things our way, we're going to finance your opponent's campaign and you're going to lose your seat in Congress.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Myrna, for the call. Jim is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. It seems to me the biggest impediment in this issue or any issue is that people don't understand the process of how people think and how they're manipulated by people. And I'd encourage people to learn everything they can about cognitive dissonance going in the net, especially under Truth Move, cognitive dissonance. And for a lot of people, it's a self-esteem issue because if you give them quotes, the facts, they'll still fight you because at some level, because of lack of self-esteem, they don't want to admit that they're wrong or that they've been conned. Charles M. Kelly wrote a book, The Great Limbaugh Con, and he said that demagogues are successful in turning haves against the have-nots because prejudice feeds on economic injustice, and economic injustice feeds on prejudice. And it means that we can't have two conflicting values at the same time without incurring a form of mental and emotional distress, which I'm distressed because I can't take unfair advantage of you and think well of you at the same time. And so there are tremendous internal pressures to reconcile these incompatible values and get emotional harmony for yourself. And so it's a vicious cycle where we have to convince ourselves that the victim deserves the behavior that we're putting on them. And if I take unfair advantage of you, I have to justify that you're a bad person and you deserve to have this happen to you, or otherwise I lose my right to call myself a Christian or moral, which is the basis for our values. So the bad feelings towards a person justifies even worse behavior, denying health benefits, for example. And that's why hatred of the poor is increasing worldwide, because it's a reminder of our moral and ethical values, and we must hate them if we're going to continue our immoral behaviors towards these people.
Thank you, Jim, very much.
Yeah.
Wendell.
What I would say, I guess, succinctly is that cognitive dissonance is real, and people do need to, I hope, learn more about the importance of language and how our thoughts and actions are manipulated, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. We are so often unaware of why we think the way we think and do the things we do, and why people vote against their own self-interest. And that was one of the reasons I wrote this book.
You say in the intro to the book, though, and I don't know, it seems, I can remember many years ago, not that many, but 5 years ago or so, bringing people to the talk table who were from all aspects, you know, American business and people who are concerned about healthcare, and people from hospitals as well, to sit on panels, and we all talked about how something had to change here. It was in the best interest of everybody because business couldn't pay the premiums, people couldn't pay the premiums, the hospitals were concerned about their end of this, and everybody seemed to have a consensus that something needs to be done, and this is what we can agree on. And then everything seemed to change, and we're back to where we were. You write at the end of your intro that we need to fight back and with urgency, otherwise the 21st century will be dominated by the retrenchment of democracy and the unbridled growth of corporate power enabled by increasingly unchallenged propaganda. It seems as though that's where we're heading. That's going to be it.
Yeah, you can look at it pessimistically, and I wrote that kind of as a call to action. We really need to make sure that we don't let that happen. I fear that we may already have lost our democracy, and that we're unknowingly a part of a plutocracy. I say unknowingly. I think people don't even know what the term means in many regards. But we really have a country that is controlled by large special interests. And in many ways, we're back in a gilded age once again, in which the wealthy, the few who are powerful and wealthy, really call the shots. And we're just duped into thinking that we have the power that we hope to have in a democracy. We've got to come to terms with that and figure out how to get our democracy back.
And when Jim described this having to see poor people as having created their own situations as the enemy in a way, did you cringe at all when he was talking? Because I want you to talk more about how you were able to exist in this world when you knew that there were some pretty horrible things that were taking place, denial of coverage. There were a lot of things that you had to just, you saw them as numbers, but what else did you have to do other than drink? I know you drank, too. You don't anymore, but you did, to deaden yourself to this.
Yeah, you have to numb yourself, but you also engage in rationalization. I think we all do to a certain extent, but certainly to the extreme, I think, if you're doing something that you ultimately know deep inside is not for the good of society as a whole. But rationalization is a big part of it. You can tell yourself that that you're company that you work for, if it's an insurance company, it provides health care coverage to, say, 10, 20, 30 million people. And you say that's a good thing.
Yes.
Those people have access to care. You don't, most folks don't have the perspective that I had toward the latter part of my career in the industry, in the executive suite, and to be able to know how these companies operate and how they make a profit to satisfy Wall Street and what they do to influence the policy making in Washington. So ignorance is part of it. They're just not aware of it. They also get caught up in the corporate culture if they are called a corporate employee. It's almost like sports teams. You want your team to win, you want your team to win in the marketplace, and you want to make sure that you are a valued team player. And if you are, you're rewarded for it personally and financially and professionally. So all that's going on. You have your ego tied up in your job. Your identity is part of who you're of your job and your title and your salary. It's hard to extricate yourself from all of that.
Mm-hmm. Josie is next from Sheboygan. Hi, Josie.
Good morning. That man Jim was such an excellent dissertation of he stole my thunder totally.
No, he didn't. Here's your go right ahead. You got the stage, Josie.
I agree with everything that's been said. It is just I am 65 years old and I just do not see anything getting better, because once they have the power, they're going to do anything to keep it. They don't work for us; they work for themselves in Congress. And except for a few, like Russ Feingold, which I was crying over his loss. But anyway, I just don't understand, with all the knowledge out there, with the information and the story after story, anecdote and things happening all the time with these insurance companies and the evil that goes on, why people believe it. I don't care what the reasoning or the language is. I don't believe anything that they say. You know, like that John Boehner, who's going to be the I can't even think now.
Speaker
so
of the
upset,
House.
But that he said it's Armageddon when the health care reform passed. I mean, asinine comment, you know. I mean, it's nowhere near what we should have as the richest country in the world. They don't care about us. I really think, you know, I heard a term, a useless eater. That's what we are to them. I heard that on another radio station, you know, and I'm really believing it. And also, this was talked about when Mark Twain was alive, with the corporate greed and the unjust war and just everything. Nothing changes. That, you know, I think humanity is really, I just don't see, you know, I know that Mark Twain, that book, I really want to get it, the first volume of his autobiography, he had a very dim view of humanity, you know, and I really think that in a lot of ways, he's saying the truth.
Okay, Wendell.
Well, it's hard to disagree with you. I try to view things optimistically and think that there is hope. We've made advances in many ways. I think we are part of evolution that hopefully will be leading us into a more progressive era eventually, and maybe one that is in which we are more aware, more intelligent, more paying more attention. But on the other hand, this scant evidence that's going to be taking place in our lifetimes. One of your earlier points, most of us aren't paying attention. We go about our day-to-day lives and tuning facts out, and we also are able to be manipulated because we think that the people we're getting our information from are believable and trustworthy, and they often are not. They often are shills for industry, and I will just say that the folks, a lot of the commentators and the pundits on Fox and conservative talk radio are misleading people, and they are getting their talking points from people like me or like I used to be. And a lot of what you're hearing, too, is just blind ideology. People are unwilling to accept that something other than what they believe and what people like them believe can be a good solution to the problems that we face. There are many people who are just adamantly convinced and cannot be persuaded otherwise that the so-called free market system couldn't work in healthcare. And I certainly believed myself that that was the case, that for a long time people should give the private companies a chance to transform the healthcare system. Well, what I saw happening was a real transformation in going the wrong way. It was a transformation that Wall Street liked, but that was to the disadvantage of most Americans.
Wendell Potter is our guest. The book is Deadly Spin, An Insurance Company Insider Speaks Out on How Corporate PR is Killing Healthcare and Deceiving Americans. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. In case you're not familiar with Wendell's story, he was the head of Cigna and Humana. Well, he wasn't the head of the whole company. He was really high up the chain in corporate PR. And he realized that there were a lot of things that were very wrong with what he was doing, and he left. And he is now speaking from another point of view as the senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. Josie, thanks for your call. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marie from La Crosse, our next caller. Hi, Marie.
Good morning. Wow, what a story to tell. I'm really on board with what your guest is saying today. My husband is a family practice physician for one of the larger groups, and I could tell you some horrific stories about what is going on underneath the surface, charging, overcharging, that kind of thing. We also have, they're paid on production now. So, there's that constant push to charge more, charge more, charge more. And if they don't, they're called to the office and they threaten them with, dismissal. And another point is we do have a grandson who has a terminal illness. He's been battling cancer for 4 years, out of remission. Now he's going back. They're thinking for more chemo, but it's terminal. And the Congress, the people in Congress who are driving this, do not understand what is going on within the family. It's about so much more than health care. It is a ripple effect. It's a tsunami. And I'm just kind of curious as to if President Obama could use a little muscle here and go, folks, we're not going home till we do something about this, and maybe embed some of these congressmen, shadow the doctors, or, pick a family who's really different families and make it mandatory that they have to spend a week with them. Because unless they can put a face on it, it is not going to change.
Wendell?
I could not agree more. I think that one of the failings of the Democrats was a failure to make people see this in human terms. The opponents of reform were able to connect with people emotionally. That term, a government takeover of the healthcare system, was a lie, but it was crafted carefully to elicit an emotional response in people. And you can do that by telling stories. It doesn't have to be anything that's false, like the opponents have done. You can tell truth, and you can tell stories in a way that these stories do put a face on the suffering of so many of our people. That brings it home in ways that people don't understand or accept other ways. And I think you're exactly right. There just wasn't enough attention paid to how to convey the message for reform.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ellen, who can at least make a comment. We're running short on time, but she's been on the phone for a while. Ellen from Milwaukee, hi.
Hello there. I agree with everything every single person on this program has said. And, yeah, they took a lot of my thunder. But I'm a nurse, and I've been seeing this going on for years. I worked at Milwaukee County Hospital. And when that hospital closed, it was the saddest day in 1995 because a lot of these people no longer had any place to go. And what happened is that they ended up in the emergency rooms of hospitals around the city, and they weren't getting proper care. They don't have a medical home.
And that's it for our conversation. Wendell Potter, thank you very much for writing the book and for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much, too. And just one final plug for the Center for Media and Democracy, which is based in Madison, a very wonderful organization that is nonprofit, nonpartisan, and worthy of support as well.
Thank you. The book is Deadly Spin. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to Chrissy for on-air production. Until tomorrow, everybody.